What does it mean to have global payments, global remittances? And if I send cryptocurrency to my friend, one, does he have access? Do he have the ability to convert it? And two, can he do it safely? And my conclusion with Bitcoin was he couldn't do it safely. And at the time, like, it was like there's a question of like, can we actually even do this inexpensively, or are the fees going to be too high? So that's where I started exploring different payment mechanisms that might provide cheaper fees and privacy.
This podcast is sponsored by CoinATM Radar. When buying crypto with cash, an ATM is much more reliable and safer than meeting some random person in a random place. And unlike an exchange, which could freeze your account, you truly own all the crypto you buy. With CoinATM Radar, you could find crypto ATMs and other services where you can buy and sell cryptocurrencies for cash. On their website, you can search by coin, address, if the ATM supports selling as well as buying, and you can also search by geo area, country, state, city. You can also check and compare actual current fees at different ATMs. If you want to find out more, head over to coinatmradar.com, which is coinatmradar.com. So, hey everyone, I have the fantastic pleasure of speaking with the one and only Josh Swyart of the Electric Coin Company, new CEO, and apologies for everyone for if there's a little bit of an expedited intro, but we were talking, the recording stopped before, and so we didn't have that. So we're kind of doing a recap. So would you mind really quick telling us how you got into crypto and your background and what led you into Zcash? Should be old hat for you, because, you know, it's like just rewind your brain for like 5 minutes ago and then we'll just go from there.
Yeah, no. All good. So yeah, my name is Josh Swyart. I'm the CEO for Electric Coin Company. I've been in the role for going on 2 weeks. Very new to the role, but not new to ECC and not new to Zcash. I joined the ECC actually in about 5 and a half, coming on 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And originally to run marketing, and was in the kind of Zcash. I was kind of a lurker before that in the community. But I had left my role. I was a senior vice president of growth, and also had responsibility for policy and regulatory relations globally. And I left on August 1st of this last year due to some change. I wanted to be vocal about some changes I was hoping to see in the Zcash ecosystem. And so I stepped away from the project and kind of engaged as a community member. And then again, just kind of recently came back. And so, and how I got in, I actually didn't get into crypto until 2016. I saw Bitcoin. I didn't think it would work. I was familiar with eCash. Mm-hmm. And I didn't kind of fully appreciate what that might mean. And so until really Ethereum. And I saw the Ethereum DAO come about, and I thought it was an interesting kind of mechanism for capital formation to allow for everybody to be able to participate, and not this kind of exclusionary system that we have in the US where you only can be an accredited investor in order to participate. Yeah, so that's where I found that fell down the rabbit hole, and I decided to focus my full-time attention on cryptocurrencies. And so I started digging in. And when I was digging in the midst of it, a friend of mine had a need. So I had lived in a prior life. I had set up an offshore development center in Anak for a software company in India. And when I was there, got involved in some community efforts in the slums of Mumbai and Pune with the Banjara people. And in one of those communities, there was a fire and my friend was unbanked. And I wanted to send some money over for food and blankets and some things with the community. And so I tried to go through Western Union and they shut me down. So I couldn't figure it out. I went into a branch office the next day, they shut me down and they wouldn't tell me why. I couldn't get anybody on customer service or anybody to tell me why I couldn't send this money to my friend who needed food and blankets. It was very frustrating. And at the same time working on cryptocurrencies and thinking, right? This is the solution to that problem. As I was looking at it, it was like, well, let's like kind of diagnose this problem a little bit more. What does it mean to have global payments, global remittances? And if I send cryptocurrency to my friend, one, does he have access? Does he have the ability to convert it? And two, can he do it safely? And my conclusion with Bitcoin was he couldn't do it safely. And at the time, like, it was like, there's a question of like, can we actually even do this inexpensively, or are the fees going to be too high? So, that's where I started exploring different payment mechanisms that might provide cheaper fees and privacy. I went to a Dash meetup. Somebody at the Dash meetup said that if you're really concerned about privacy, then you ought to look at this project that that will be released later in the year. That was 2016, called Zcash. And so that's when I started following, knocking on the door of it was called the Zcash company at that time.
Yeah, I remember those days.
Yeah, and eventually they agreed to hire me to come on. So that's how I got here.
Yeah, and so as you mentioned about, you know, the privacy thing, that's something that a lot of people haven't really thought of. It's kind of an afterthought for a lot of people in crypto, even today in almost 2024, right? Where people just stay like, oh, well, no one knows, it's all anon. Or the super privacy focused people will just, you know, get a new address every time. Well, or throw it through a mixer, like just do a coin join their entire balance and then send it. And so thinking that no one in this age who's observing a transaction graph can just see balance go in, balance go out, and just connect the dots. And we're kind of way past that in terms of what governments and companies are talking about, isn't that right?
Yeah, so I'll like do a little tinfoil hat time, because I have some experience with this on the other side and where I came from. So so I ran a software, you know, I ran a software company just prior to this, and prior to that I did some other stuff, including working for a consulting company that ran a program to build an intelligence system, a surveillance system for a foreign government. And the contract, what we were focused on was bringing together, aggregating data from multiple different sources in order to be able to get some kind of indication of what might be happening on the ground. So a lot of that data came from satellite systems, some of it came from UAVs or drones, some of it came from field intelligence. And what was interesting is, like, with a picture, with a given snapshot, you're able to see an image of like an airbase, and you can see the planes around it. So you have some kind of information. What gets interesting is the next snapshot. It's the movement over time. It's the changes, the deltas over time. So how did the planes move? Are there more planes or less planes? Are there different kind of planes? What are the payloads? Who are the pilots? What are the support vehicles around them? And what might that country either be doing or trying to signal by those kind of movements? And fast forward, there's a company, the architect that I was working with, he was a software architect on that project, started another company called Aspenware that I eventually became the CEO of. It was largely consulting, and got a contract to do some work for actually a state that wanted to do targeted advertising. And we started, and I came and worked with him, and what we were able to do is to start using those same techniques to do targeted advertising. And so what that meant at that time is we were able to aggregate data. We aggregated data from about 26 different social media sites, things that people were willingly posting online, which includes things that they're saying on social channels. It includes pictures that they take. And then it includes the delta, right, that how that information changes over time in order to get a complete profile. So, Joel, like, I would be able to put in your name and say, okay, this is the guy. And say, this is where he lives. Maybe not you, maybe you're more privacy, careful, but this is where he lives, this is who kids are. This is where the person likes to travel. This is whether they have, how much discretionary income, what kind of travel do they like? Do they like resort style traveling? Mm-hmm. Do they like rock climbing? Do they like fishing? Actually, we can tell all of that based upon both the data as well as as well as using the photo itself, because we can do edge detection and tell what's in the photo, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that if you take two pictures of food, that's highly correlated to you being a resort style traveler. So then we can say, okay, we're going to take that information, that aggregated information, and we're going to target you with advertising. What's the intent with advertising? The intent is to try to manipulate behavior, right? So now I have this online medium with advertising where I can do target response, target response, target response. I give you an ad. Do you respond to it? How long do you look at that ad before you choose to scroll down, right? And can I give you a different ad to get a different response? And every time you click on something or watch something or choose to do something, then I have more information about you that I can use to try to manipulate your behavior to get you to do the thing that I want to do. So now imagine you have all of that information, and this is happening, right? We're at this point, we're a small company. And by the way, we shut this program down. It got super creepy. In fact, our internal tool was called Creepy Crawler, but we had a government contractor reach out and said, hey, actually, we want to get this information. We want to be able to use this information to determine whether or not somebody would be a good employee for us, because we find certain types of employees tend to do better here. So they wanted to go out, use this social information that was available online to profile potential employees. And this was happening years ago without anybody knowing. Now you have all of that information that's out there, which has only gotten worse. And you have your cryptocurrency, right? So what wallets do you have? Where do you store it? And all that information is getting tagged, actively tagged right now. And then the transaction graph between it. And what's not even, you know, what's, you know, part of that is like, again, it's like the value of where it sits today in terms of an address, but what are the changes in behavior over time? How does that coincide with all of the rest of the details that you're leaving out on the internet? And how can we use that information to try to manipulate behavior in order to try to get the outcomes that you want? That is actually happening. It's not just tinfoil hat, but it happens very kind of passively underneath where we don't even know it. So our privacy is, and our choice effectively is being gradually eroded over time. And so that was part of the scary wake up call that I had years ago. And so that's why when I started getting cryptocurrencies, it's like, holy crap. If
this is that, more, you know, data all of that, out there.
It's just more data that gives me more information to be able to do things, whether I'm a thief, like you're talking about, or whether I'm a company that wants you to get to buy something, or whether I'm trying to control a narrative. And I want to get certain people to behave in certain ways.
Yeah. I think that, some of these like very real examples, the idea of privacy and spying, and like as much good as Edward Snowden did in all his disclosures, I think a lot of that went over people's heads where they just don't realize the scope. They don't realize what it means, all this kind of stuff. And, on the other end of that sort of spectrum, there's a couple of TikTok creators that I'm a fan of their work who do basically privacy exposés. One, Jose Monkey, is a guy who takes one Google image or someone just says, hey, find me, and he finds him anywhere in the world he is based on like correlation of like, well, based on the sun going at this angle and the shadows of this tree on this, and it's all amateur stuff. And then Nat Khan Jr. takes someone's profile and just finds their exact full name and legal name and birth date, and from just nothing. And some of these people have deleted Facebook accounts and everything, and it's just, you know, going to find like other people who might have tagged them before they deleted their account, looking through friends and family, correlating by, in this is all super amateur work from just like random people on the internet who just are bored. And I think that if people start to correlate that with other things and then start to do choices behind it, like, you know, something affecting your credit score at a very a very lower level, right, based on that, and then advertising, you know, a lot of people don't care if they're being advertised to, but then when you start to have, like, you know, your rates go up because they know you're in a bad situation and you will pay more for this thing, and that's just like that doesn't even go towards like missing job opportunities, spying from political opponents, and like all that kind of stuff. And it just goes worse from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this correlation, I mean, that's exactly the same kind of stuff, right? When you're looking at satellite imagery, you're looking at the same kind of data in order to make an assessment of what you're looking at. But now add AI. So you have a person that's doing that right now and aggregating, knows how to do it. But it's all plugged into a system that can do that exponentially faster. That's going to change everything. So like this kind of notion at some point, the blinds have to come off, and people realize how much of their, not just financial information, but that's a huge piece of it, is exposed to, we're just naked and exposed to powers in this world, right? That they want to be able to use that.
Yeah, and so now we go back to the whole ECC thing. And so Zuko Wilcox, fantastic man. Everyone loves Zuko, kind of. Well, not everyone, but most people, like, he's a figure of the privacy space for a very long time, a figure of the crypto space for a very long time, a brilliant mind, all this kind of stuff. I don't think he's someone who needs to, like, prove his worth more in the space. Like, I think he deserves a little retirement from the spotlight. And so Zuko's taking a break. And then how did the conversation come about for you to step in to replace him as not as Zuko, obviously, but as CEO of ECC?
Yeah, look, Zuko is legend, right? Mm-hmm. And he's a OG cypherpunk, part of that community, right? And there's very, you know, as the whole crypto industry is increasingly kind of financialized and co-opted by traditional kind of financial powers, there's a few that are the tried and true OG, have weathered this thing and have probably aged themselves by many decades just by sticking around for so long. There's a few, and he's definitely one. So he's a hero, and he definitely deserves that respect. The conversation with change, I mean, there's conversations with change that happened even before I left, and there's just questions about how long Zuko wanted to, you know, continue in the role, and when was the right time, and all of that kind of thing. And it didn't really kind of come to a head. They were just kind of conversations, and I don't want to get into the specifics of all of the kind of what happened between the time that I left and coming back. Mm-hmm. But conversations about change generally, that you know, the project needed some change, needed to be able to focus more on adoption, needed to heal some things then in terms of governance and some things between the foundation and ECC. The community needed to heal, and we needed to build some new momentum with some new ideas. That came out as Econ. So there was a lot of that conversation there, and that's where some of my conversation started. Mm-hmm. And then it continued, both with Zuko, and it continued with a number of people across the Zcash ecosystem. There's a lot of community members that were wanting to see change and had some ideas and that kind of thing. And there were a lot of private conversations that happened. And then there were a lot of conversations that happened between me and the ECC board of directors, specifically about what that might look like. Mm-hmm. And for a while I was thinking, you know, I'm going to start something new within the Zcash ecosystem. But I think the entire board of directors at ECC, we're great about, you know, engaging and thinking about the future and wanting to see some of these transitions. So I put everything else on pause while those conversations happened with ECC.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And so you alluded to, like, dissatisfaction and changes that needed to happen. And obviously there's a new direction, and I know you posted publicly about a few of these changes, such as the re-open sourcing completely of the Zcash code, et cetera. And so do you want to just real quick, well, not really quick, because, you know, the heart of the conversation is, what do you think that Zcash had a lacking of historically up until now? And then, of course, the next chapter is, what do you hope to do about that?
Yeah, there's a few things, and maybe I hit some of them that are significant. I think one that's significant is I think it's been too hard to engage with the Zcash ecosystem and engage with the core developers and that kind of thing, in that we have kind of siloed people off. Mm-hmm. So we have the Zcash Foundation, which is doing this amazing work around an alternative consensus node, ZebraD, and we have ECC, which has the legacy Zcashd, which is what most of the industry still uses as a consensus node, and has been doing a lot of R&D and a lot of the driving of these new kind of cryptographic breakthroughs. Sapling was one in terms of performance. Orchard was another in terms of eliminating trusted setup, and a lot of that work being done at ECC. But it's very complicated work. And with the case of Zcash D, it's all legacy C++ code that was ported over. You know, it was a fork of Bitcoin, and then building on top of it creates this kind of complexity in dealing with legacy technical debt, mm-hmm. as well as kind of keeping, you know, track of changes on Bitcoin, on Bitcoin side. So, so inherently the team, you know, at ECC had been very focused and heads down, but I think we're moving to a time where a lot of that core protocol work, there's some other kind of big questions and things to work on, no doubt, but we need to better equip the community to be able to flourish and build things. Mm-hmm. So ECC has largely kind of been out of conversations on things like the forum with developers around ideas and different ways of solving problems. If it was something that historically ECC disagreed with, or you know that we wouldn't typically engage. And so we need to kind of move into a place where there's a broader marketplace of ideas. There's more participation. There's more ideation in public forums. And that the strength of this kind of core team at ECC, which is incredibly talented and gifted team, is able not just to focus on its own stuff, but also to unleash a whole community to be able to build more on top of it. Because we want to work on things to find product market fit, and we'll release some products along those lines that has a way of engaging the user. But the people that we're working and living and doing things in different contexts may have some different needs, right? And so how do we unleash these people to be able to create the things that they need on top of Zcash and this protocol that we have? Alongside of, you know, how do we set them loose? And we've got to set our core teams loose to be able to do that. So that's one maybe significant change. There's some governance changes that I think need to happen that we'll talk about. We have conversations about long-term funding and funding mechanisms and the current dev fund and whether or not that creates the right incentives. Questioned after I left ECC, whether that actually drives the right incentives. And I think we need to explore some of those things as a community. So those are some of the major things. And again, like the focus on user experience, usability, and taking a hard look and saying, okay, there's one thing of building and hoping they will come and wishing they'll come. And there's another kind of more rapidly deploying solutions that people can use and seeing what works and what doesn't work and continually adjusting. And I think we need to move more in that direction.
Yeah. There's a million different ways we could go here, but the one thing I like that you mentioned the funding mechanism and not specifically, is there enough funding, but are the incentives right for the kind of outcomes you want? And this is something I've been sort of personally, a personal mental journey I've had over the last decade or so in crypto is, at first I saw, you know, I was all in on Bitcoin, and then in 2016, but for a lot of people it was 2017, it stopped working. And what we see now is freedom money that doesn't work for freedom money anymore for anything but, you know, the uber rich basically. And also being pushed into custodial type solutions and federated things like Liquid, which was prime product of the company that hired a whole lot of the Bitcoin developers back in the day. And it's like, I don't think you need a tinfoil hat to kind of connect some of those incentives. And so the next thought was, okay, self-funding, self-governance is the way to go. And so, you know, but went deep into the Dash world from there. When Zcash came out, obviously I was like, this is perfectly in line. Having like a dev fund going is great. And then there's an inescapable sort of thought of, well, that solved one problem, but there's another one that might have been created by that. And it's hard to quite figure out. And the incentives seem to be part of it. And I have a lot of ideas, but I can't say that in my own mind, I've solved the problem of how do you get the most out of this? Because if you look at the broadness of the crypto space, it seems like the super decentralized, like, community driven, all that kind of stuff type things are the ends of the bell curve. They're either like grin, which just goes nowhere, or they're like, you know, no offense, but and that, or you're like, you know, the Bitcoin, maybe like Coin, Bitcoin Cash, Monero, whatever you want to call it, that still has zero funding mechanism, but just manages to thrive and keep going after that. I mean, obviously, you know, it's subjective as far as what you'd call thriving. But then you have the middle of the bell curve where you have a whole lot of projects with some kind of built-in funding that always manage to deliver some cool tech, build some nice stuff, but then just sort of like slide off, like the IOTAs of the world, to name just another one. And then just a lot of those kinds of projects just, you know, Furo, it does great work in, you know, the privacy space as far as innovation and stuff, but and has self-funding, but, you know, kind of off by the wayside. So what do you think that is? And it seems like Zcash might be in the middle of the bell curve in that kind of example of it's, you know, probably I would call it one of the biggest innovators in the entire crypto space, where you have like Bitcoin starting things, and then you have like Ethereum kicking off the whole programmability thing, and then Zcash doing like advancing the state of the art for, you know, privacy technology. But then you have like, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then Zcash isn't in the conversation the way, in my personal opinion, it really should be. It should be, you know, top 10, right? And so do you think, what do you think about all that? What do you think about the incentives of the self-funding model? Is a self-funding model maybe not such a good idea? Is it a great idea but hasn't been applied right? Is it a great idea that has been applied right, but maybe there's some external factors that screwed things up or whatever? What do you think?
Yeah, so I'll give you my opinions, and they're my personal opinions. Mm-hmm. One, the self-funding model, like at the outset, was like it was hugely important, right? So it allowed for the company to initially be established, to have a revenue stream kind of out of the gate in order to be able to support this development. And I think people forget, unless you've been around for a while, like zero knowledge was a math paper. There was no practical application of zero knowledge until Zcash. There had nobody that had been able to translate that theory from MIT like 30 years ago to code. And so the complexity in being able to do this, right? And these are like some of the brightest minds in the world have been working on zero knowledge cryptography and operationalizing. And you have a team that was able to take that from theory to workable software in a very short period of time with a very limited amount of funding. But the funding that fueled that came from what was initially the founder's reward. Mm-hmm. It allowed for the fueling of that development, and it allowed for a partnership between Zcash holders. It allowed people people to kind of come in, right, and get access to it and to support the project in that way. And so Orchard wasn't performant, which was the first cryptography that was used, not Orchard, excuse me, Sprout, mm-hmm, wasn't performant, which was the first shielded pool, but that is essentially, it's the first cryptography that was used.
Yeah. I have a personal story on the performance of Sprout, which is a friend of mine bought something from a physical shop with a Sprout shielded transaction. And he was there with his laptop on command line for like 10 minutes generating a thing to buy something, which is awesome at the same time as it is, you know, a clear sign that we needed to get past that.
Right. There's like a very, you know, point whatever percent of the population that's willing to, you know, download a full node and run command line in order to make a payment using shielded ZEC. But there's like been this whole series of innovations. So Sapling and now Orchard. In Orchard, again, we just open sourced for the whole community like last week. But the complexity and the challenge of being able to make cryptographic breakthrough after cryptographic breakthrough that now like everybody is taking for granted. And so you hear all of the ZK stuff on Ethereum and so on, and how ZK is changing everything, whether it's rollups or privacy or what have you, all of that, the headwaters of that are at ECC and are as a result of the chain being able to pay the developers to be able to to do that and to have a fair distribution of coins, right? Mm-hmm. So because of the proof of work mining out of the gate with the support with the developers, coins could be easily, you know, it wasn't locked up with some VC mm-hmm. who was saying, this is where I want the project to go. And I hold, you know, 30% of the tokens or whatever. So I think that was really cool. It's just now I think we've gotten to a place where it's maybe created some perverse incentives, and the opposite is happening, where the organizations like the one that I run have been receiving coins at these 4-year chunks. And so you're starting to think in these 4-year timeframes, which is way too long. It's like, I have this amount of funding roughly because the coin price goes up and down, but I have this much funding for the next 4 years, which, you know, kind of breeds a certain way of thinking. So imagine if you're a company, right, and you're selling products and you're like, well, I've got one customer essentially for 4 years. So what happens, right? You kind of push off some things and it maybe doesn't drive the right kind of energy, and it maybe doesn't allow you to prove that you have or really push for product market fit. It gives you a lot of time. So there are things that need to happen slowly. Like cryptographic breakthroughs don't happen through, V1 to V1.1 of, you know, releasing an app. They take many weeks, many months, many years. And so I think there is a place for allowing R&D and long-term R&D to happen via funding models like that. Whether it's through a guaranteed dev fund or whether it's a grant program, don't know. And there's a separate, I think there can be like points of accountability, but allowing space for people to experiment and make mistakes where you're not marching on a firm timeline. So there's absolutely room for that. But I think there needs to be, that can't be the only thing, right? So at ECC, it was very difficult, one, to like build new innovative things to have enough funding because of the way the structure was set up, and even to launch programs, marketing programs or other things. One is products that needed to kind of get out the door quickly and be tested were tightly coupled with our protocol work. Mm-hmm. So we're separating those things out so we can run fast and run slow. And maybe those running fast kinds of things can be funded in other different ways rather than a guaranteed dev fund, and it's probably more appropriate for them to be funded in other ways. So I'll pause there, but I think that's the. So it's I'm not crapping on the dev fund. I think it you know it's allowed for some amazing things, but we need a change in how it's done, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely, and that does make perfect sense. Especially since if you think about the delivery of funds mechanism, it's not just the 4-year interval. It's also, in the free market, which is, you know, the most efficient system in the world, you have a very real data feed to your successes, which is, you know, company revenue, for example. You make sales and your revenue versus your expenses, and that's what you do. And if you don't make things happen, you make no money. Right, you're done. There's nothing, and you could have a 4-year cycle of just working really hard, and there's not a lot of ways of concretely measuring successes. You can say, okay, we set out to do these technological innovations. We overperformed. We made a cool wallet here. That looks great. We did this, and you kind of make up metrics to, you know, to try to make it seem like, okay, I know what I'm doing, but without that, I guess, market in alignment, where you have people, you're actually selling a product, and then the product owners are paying, the people who buy it are paying you. And if they're not paying you, you got to figure that out. That whole thing's sort of like, you know, broken a little bit. And to a certain extent, this has been sort of the dichotomy in crypto, right? Because you have things like, say, Bitcoin or whatever else, where a lot of people are working full time to promote Bitcoin, and there's no Bitcoin dev fund. But part of that is, of course, the grandfather and the idea of all of crypto succeeds if Bitcoin does. But also a lot of these companies like exchanges support a bunch of different coins and they're not Bitcoin focused. The Bitcoin focused companies these days, I've noticed, don't tend to do very well. They tend to get a burst of like maximalist virtue signaling support, and then they don't really have a good business model and they go away. But you find that out, and I've noticed that some of the best promoters of Monero these days have been Cake Wallet, and because it's a for-profit company run by some people. I believe at least one person used to be part of the Monero core team, whatever that means. But they seem to be doing very well at promoting, but at the same time, they're also, you know, adding a bunch of different coins like Nano, Target. They have a lot of like split loyalties, I guess, which loyalty is not something we should really have in crypto, in my opinion, other than to the principles of, you know, permissionless, private, decentralized finance. But you see a lot of like, okay, either you have a dev fund of some kind, you do really well at building the tech for your project, but it doesn't get out there, it doesn't grow. Or you're really good at growth, but then you kind of are pulled in a few different directions until, you know, Blockstream comes in and puts you into one that might be completely unaligned with your users or your core mission. And so just do you have any idea on more specifically? I mean, you alluded to separating the two things out, right? Of like the protocol could be a 4-year kind of a thing still. That seems to be working well as far as the innovations there. But the product kind of, the end user product area being not quite that way. And so do you have any preliminary ideas of like what not that quite that way might look like, or is still keeping that close to your chest?
No, I'm pretty transparent, but I think you articulated the challenge really well as it relates to market dynamics and not getting that feedback based upon whether or not somebody's willing to spend a Satoshi on mm-hmm. you know, a piece of software or not and actually use it. I put a post out there a number of months ago, like as I was leaving or right after I left. And it was just a concept, not a proposal. But the concept was, do we have funding that's available to people that have software that's actively being used to manage the network is mm-hmm. Dev funding, right? So people that are maintaining core consensus protocols and just for the maintenance and keeping that stuff running. And then maybe that there's grant funding over and above that, that can be in smaller chunks and for more speculative things. Now, grant funding could be like, we want to do R&D, but maybe more specific. So we want to do R&D. One group says we want to do R&D around proof of stake. Another group says we want to do R&D around alternative payment mechanisms or maybe ZSAs or something like that. And the community then effectively through that grant making can determine where it wants to focus its R&D efforts and to whom and to how much. So it's not just a dev fund recipient saying, I get to decide what R&D looks like and I'll let you know, right? The community has a more active voice and there's more accountability for some of that R&D on top of the protocol. And then likewise, more speculative things could come in the form of grants. Mm. But historically, we've been thinking about these organizations as non-for-profit. So ECC is wholly owned by a 501c3 called Bootstrap. And the foundation is not-for-profit, you know, some other orgs. And there's good kind of virtue signaling with that mm-hmm. and saying, hey, we're not trying to make any money. We're doing this in the best interest of the community and all this kind of stuff. But it also creates this problem that you've identified, right? Of that we're not getting real market feedback. So maybe there's mechanisms for others to in the ecosystem to be for-profit entities, still receive maybe some grant funding to get off the ground, and then be able to raise capital through other sources to be able to build kind of interesting tools, and they'll live and die based upon whether or not they're successful in delivering real products to the market. So there needs to be like a kind of an ecosystem that way, but that may mean reducing. Ironically, I'm saying ECC it may be reducing the amount of guaranteed money that it receives mm-hmm. if the community decides it wants to move forward with an ongoing dev fund and force folks like us to be more creative and more active in delivering products to market.
Yeah, absolutely. And that makes perfect sense that you'd want to have something a little bit more, you know, focused on that. And the question, of course, becomes, is ECC the entity to do the end user kind of thing?
Yeah, that's the question. Yep. So one of the things, like, we have a ECC is getting together as a team for a series of workshops called ZBoot, and that will be like end of January, beginning of February. And we had done some of these kinds of workshops in the past. I think it kind of died with COVID and then depressed coin price and that kind of thing. And it really hurt ECC just in terms of our collaboration, cross team collaboration, ideation, and building momentum. So we're going to restart those. The little bit of a thing that I'm doing with this first one, and want to try to continue, is inviting the community to participate. And so if people are builders or interested in contributing, then inviting those workshops will be open to those people. And so what we want to do is we want to kind of collaboratively look at what are the various options in front of us that will help us drive Zcash adoption. Where are the gaps? Where are the friction points? What are the quick wins and what things maybe take longer? And so building out a roadmap, both for ECC in collaboration with the community, where it allows the community too to understand what ECC is doing, how it's thinking and where it might contribute, and then how ECC can get behind some of these other efforts. You know, that will kind of allow us to build that roadmap where there are products. So there are some ideas, interesting ideas that I'd like to explore related to collateralizing assets for payments cross-chain, for maybe even hardware. We'll see. But we need to we'll start digging in on that in you know, in the end of January.
Yeah, and so from the end user perspective, right? So I have, I guess, used Zcash since basically inception. I haven't, not very frequently, of course, especially not in the beginning, but in the last year or so, whenever Zuko came to town, he's always very, one thing that you can definitely respect is he's definitely trying to spread the gospel, as it were. Like, he's trying to get, he got some of the local baristas at the coffee shop to get some wallets and get them set up, and, you know, got me go kind of back into that kind of stuff. And then over the course of a year, I had a grant with a minor grant to do the Zcash podcast. And so there I goes, you know, earning Zcash and like wanting to spend it around. And I found out that, well, the two challenges is, first of all, that was right when the whole sandblasting episode began. And that's kind of a what one could easily call a dead zebra, to stop beating a dead zebra there. But, you know, basically being able to a side effect of that, which might deserve, you know, to be mentioned specifically, isn't just, oh, wallets aren't working. It's the wallet I recommend to new users changes every few months. Whereas at first there was a lot of people who had Zek wallet. Zek wallet, I have never had a bad experience while things were up. But then, you know, then that went away. And then it's like, okay, well, what now? And it's like, okay, well, Y Wallet, I never been a fan of Y Wallet. No offense to the developers behind it and stuff. And then Zingo, we're all using Zingo now. And then I don't know if Zingo is the one people are using anymore. I hear people talking about, well, maybe not that one, or wait for Zashi to come out. Or so there's been that thing. But the biggest thing is, I was sort of surprised that for a well-entrenched coin, like the, you know, it was listed on Gemini and things like that, and, you know, his big Flexa partnership and all this kind of stuff, how hard it was to actually use my Zcash in day-to-day life. I did use Flexa a few different times, but mostly I don't go to Dunkin' Donuts that much. And so there was like, there's only so much I could do there. And then I paid a designer, a contractor, to do some work for, you know, some graphic work and other things like that. And then I paid a, you know, a physical contractor in Zcash to do some work on the house. And it seems like the peer-to-peer way is like almost the entire way I could do that. I did pay people back for dinner and stuff like that. But the actual infrastructure around, like, what like, here's, you know, super private digital cash, what do I do with it? And largely the answer is, you know, donate to some nonprofits and then you know, virtue signal on Twitter about how much you love privacy. No, it's like, yeah. As far as like, what do you do with it seems to have been lacking. So first off, is that something that ECC specifically is going to tackle, or is this something that's left for other entities in the community?
Well, the answer is it's not an or. I think it's an and. So, you know, hopefully, again, we can get behind and support various projects that are building cool things. And again, like, no offense to the wallet developers in the Zcash ecosystem, but man, it all looks like software that was built in the 90s or something. And
part of it's that not might be seamless. Because the Zcash community loves it. They might be like, oh, it's like,
it could be. But like, we desperately need to modernize the user experience. And the user experience is not just, I'm not just talking about pixels on the screen, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the, you reference the sandblasting, it's like sync. Is that a problem? Like, when I go to pay somebody and I open my wallet and my, you know, stuff is not syncing, even if it's like I've now got to spend before sync or things like that. But just the, like, that I'm looking at a progress wheel and it's like creeping around and I don't feel like I'm completely up to speed. It's like, that's UX friction. So how do we do that? How do we eliminate that? And then we got this other challenges, right? With access. So how do people around the world have access to Zcash? It used to be that you could GPU mine. And so you had a lot of, you know, hobbyists and people around the world that were doing that. And then ASICs hit in 2018 or whatever, and it couldn't do it anymore. And now we're heavily, heavily reliant on centralized exchanges. Huge, huge problem. How do we get Zcash in the pockets of folks, and how do we get them to be able to earn it or things like that? I think Ian Zacksetter brought up, you know, that's really important. I totally agree with him. It's really important for people to be able to earn Zac. But if we as a community are relying on centralized exchanges that are means for distribution and access, it's a huge problem. So we need to look at that as well, right? That's all part of user experience.
Yeah. And I'll actually speak on that, cause that's a good segue into the whole, you know, recent news kind of thing. So, first off, OKX, I believe as of today, or I don't remember when, but they're going to be removing a whole bunch of trading pairs associated with privacy assets of whatever, wherever they perceive as such. And Binance also is doing something very baffling in they're doing kind of the same thing, but they specifically don't like transparent addresses with Zcash. They don't think it's enough, which is hilarious to me that, in my opinion, in my perception, I should say, Gemini is one of the most scrutinized regulated exchanges, one of the most scrutinized regulated jurisdictions in the entire planet. And they're like, well, you know, we feel comfortable doing shielded assets. And it's not the same. Like, Binance is like, can you change your, you know, again, go back with the meme, can devs do something? Can you change the address type? Can you have a new address type that doesn't let you do transparent to shielded? It's only transparent to transparent. And then for that. So first of all, on that very specific request, what's the thought process on, like, from like ECC on that?
On the Binance?
Yeah. On their specific request.
Name, whatever they're calling. And like, it's total bunk. It's total bunk because yes, it's not what the developers can do something, it's what the exchange is. And you outlined that very thing. You said Gemini over here, under NYDFS, highly regulated, is supporting fully shielded transactions, right? Or supporting transactions to a Z address and from. Why? Because they have put the processes in place to be able to do that. They have said, we're willing to put the processes in place to meet our compliance obligations. It's not that they're saying we won't comply. They're completely complying. They're saying, well, what we're going to do, what we told NYDFS that we'll do, is that if transactions happen that are kind of outside of band or weird, they'll get flagged. And if you come, if you subpoena us, then we'll have to give you information because that's the law. And they may ask you source of funds. Now, the way that they ask about source of funds in Coinbase, I think Coinbase is more intrusive than Gemini has been as it relates to, you know, that particular question. But in both cases, they put in controls, completely compliant. Mm-hmm. And they've, you know, the Binance stuff is freaking excuse. It's an excuse. It's an excuse not to do the work. They have options. They are just saying, well, the easiest thing for us, because right now, understand that under this settlement agreement with the DOJ, you know, and these financial powers in the U.S., the financial powers in the U.S. are in Binance's systems. They see all the stuff. They're pulling the strings and controlling the thing. That's not tinfoil hat. They've said it, right? That is actually what's happening. And so the this kind of decision to move in this direction is not a financial decision. It doesn't help them to remove these pairs of these coins. They lose trading volume, right? It makes no sense. It's because they are being compelled by regulators through shadow regulations, not through actual regulations.
Yeah,
through
that's shadow regulations. Real dirty part.
It happens all the time. It happens all the time with exchanges. We've seen it before with the number of exchanges that have gone down. We've had, you know, this people can't talk about it because they worry about getting, you know, thrown in jail or whatever. But this is what goes down. So the stuff that happens, even like with Mika, Mika gets in the EU, which is regulation, which it's kind of broad crypto regulation, and it includes some language about privacy, and there's some concerning language in there, but it has to be interpreted by various jurisdictions, and it has to be interpreted by the exchanges. So you have folks like Coinbase, which have stood up and said, Zcash complies, our support of Zcash completely complies with Mika regulations. Mm-hmm. It's very different than you get the message from Binance. Why? Which one is under this regulatory scrutiny for all the shady stuff that happened on their platform over all these years, right?
Of course.
Now they've got, so I wonder with OKX, so OKX news, I think it's January 4th where they said they're going to stop. Start with the trading pairs, and they listed all these coins, right? Like coins that don't even support privacy. They're ticking a box because you have some. It's either knee jerk because you have a regulator that's threatening them, or you have a bank that's threatening them, willing to say like, look, we're gonna you can't bank with us anymore. But it's not a proactive response. It's not an honest assessment of what the local regulations are and how OKX or how Binance can comply with those regulations in a safe way, as Coinbase has done, as I believe Kraken has done, as Gemini has done. It's just a total excuse. So throwing it back on the devs and say, hey, like, just open all of this stuff up, like make fundamental changes to consensus protocol to conform to how we want. It's like chasing the wind, because it's going to freaking change every time. They're going to change the rules because they just don't like the regulators don't like the capability. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
yeah,
that's it's I think people should vote with their feet and not support these exchanges. Mm-hmm. That are making these kinds of decisions. Like, and at the same time, we need to provide more options for more people around the world to be able to get access to that.
Yeah. Which kind of brings back to my thought process as recently is DEX or GTFO. And this sort of started when the whole cross-chain DEX space, I didn't really care too much about the DeFi, all that stuff, because a lot of it was just Ethereum and whatever casino tokens are on there that people just wanted to swap around on Uniswap. Again, I'm being a little bit unfair in that characterization, but you get what I'm saying. And it wasn't until ThorChain came around that this made sense. I mean, I can put Bitcoin in here and ETH comes out. I can get Bitcoin Cash from Litecoin. Wow, this is good stuff. And so ever since then, I've been pushing to get all my favorite coins on ThorChain. And ThorChain for a while, I have nothing bad really to say about the protocol itself and the innovations, but there were some issues with how the team chose to deal with projects seeking to be listed or whatever, about like stringing some along saying, oh yeah, we should. And I've seen a lot of developers for ThorChain talk positively about it would make sense to add Zcash. But then I honestly believe the chance of that happening is like 1-2%. I'm super bearish on ThorChain specifically. Now, having had gone through that whole thing from the Dash community perspective of being explicitly promised by ThorChain and then it just, you know, well, now we have a node voting thing and now that's not going to work. ThorChain's first major fork, which was released this year, the Maya protocol, was more than happy to take the Dash integration. And so now the same interfaces that use ThorChain, you can just click a button and then get the Maya menu and swap them. And so I feel like so relieved now as a frequent Dash user that Dash is on in the greater Thorchain ecosystem that is now has a third actor, which is Chainflip, and next year is going to have, hopefully, Sarai Dex, which will support Monero. And so the point is, we have this fancy Thorchain integration paid for by Zcash, by, you know, for Nighthawk to do this stuff. And from what I'm being told from the Maya people is they would love to have Zcash, but the ball's kind of in Zcash's court to make that kind of happen. And if you look at episode 10 of the Zcash podcast, I had Adi from Nighthawk on with Alux of the Maya protocol. So if you want to get like a giant thing about that, but basically, in my opinion, in my personal opinion, every single crypto that wants to be used as like real things, as real money, any privacy thing especially, has to be on one of those Thorchain ecosystem, whether it's Thorchain, Maya, whether it's Chainflip, which I believe is more Polkadot focused right now, I could be wrong, and or Sarai when Sarai ends up coming out. And obviously, like, Monero technically is the hardest to get involved with all this, which is why it's like far out, but there's no reason why Zcash can't be in this ecosystem other than people on someone somewhere is like not making a priority. So I don't, that's not exactly a question. That's more of a, hey, what do you think about pushing for Zcash to get on something like Maya, which is explicitly said that it would entertain that offer?
Okay. I need to, it sounds like I need to watch that episode, and I'm curious about what those friction points are. Mm-hmm. I don't know the details yet, but I think we need to push for this kind of DEX integration. And again, these options, we can't kind of live in this little side. We can't like wish the whole Binance OKX kind of situation away. I mean, the reality is that these exchanges provide the interface for, you know, for much of retail to be able to use and access crypto, and retail needs access to these tools, right? And so, and it's got to be seamless all the way up, right? It can't be, a DEX can't be too complex, right? So I need to be able to, like from the Nighthawk wallet, say, okay, I have some Bitcoin, I want to buy some ZEC, some shielded ZEC, and to have that kind of experience within the user interface, completely seamless. Those are the kinds of tools that we need. We need the DEXs on the back end to make that work. And in some ways we've like freaking gone backwards. Like when I got started and when Zcash, you know, even first launched, Shapeshift was like one of the first places where you could buy in easily, and the user interface for it, at the time I thought like it was so easy. The fees were a little bit more, but it was just so easy. To use, yeah, compared to anything else. And just to go to a site, plug in, I want to swap this for this, and to be able to do it within the kind of geo-fenced United States of America, it was an amazing experience. And it's too bad that's gone. But so hopefully we can build some better tools from some of the wallets like that. But we do, and I do commit at ECC that we will support DEX integration.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Shapeshift, because Shapeshift has been through the whole system of like, they start out this too good to be true in retrospect. They had to do accounts and then KYC. And then finally Eric just torpedoed the entire business and said, we're going to be a DAO now building DEXs. And now the Shapeshift app is a front end for a bunch of DEXs, including Thorchain and very possibly Maya in the coming months. So it's kind of funny how that whole thing, Shapeshift is still alive in spirit, but also alive in itself. It just evolved. And so I kind of feel as sort of a, I get a very interesting feeling about 2024, having been in this space for over 10 years now. I get the feeling 2024 is almost like getting the band back together year of where like all the cool stuff that made us nostalgic back in the day. Like, I feel like a lot of people are getting back fully involved and stuff. I mean, obviously you're trying to make Zcash great again, you know, with just taking back the cypherpunk roots. Vitalik, I did not have a chance to read it, but he did write a post about making Ethereum cypherpunk again. I think it was yesterday or something like that. It was recently. And we're hitting this point where, you know, Bitcoin is starting to solidify its place as a settlement asset and something for large institutions and investors, and not so much a cypherpunk tool. And like, I feel like we're at a spot of like rebirth type thing, where a lot of the OGs and the OG values in the ecosystem have kind of been dormant for a little while. And I feel like a lot of those same individual figures, but also values and projects, are going to come roaring back in the new year. I don't know if you have a similar feeling about where we're going.
I totally agree with you, Joel. I think the financialization and the stuff that's happening there in the ETFs and all that kind of stuff, actually, I think I lament a lot that it's regulatory capture, that it's TradFi capture of the space. But there's another truth in there. And the other truth is it's the open door to for retail, for people to kind of get in and fall down that rabbit hole. And then once they're able to see the difference, if we're doing a good job in our kind of cypherpunk world, then it will become a better alternative. So just see the TradFi stuff as a waypoint back to the roots of what we're actually trying to build, that allows us to build more and get more people in, and to ultimately break what's happening with TradFi. So we'll see how it plays out, but that's the theory I like to believe in.
Yeah. Fantastic. It's I'm going to be working very hard as well to try to make sure this whole thing happens. We get in a good spot. I think one thing that, a clip that I posted from an interview I did with the founder of the Maya Protocol not too long ago was, he believes it's like 5 more years, we 2 more cycles, and all this will be over with. That we will be able to separate money from state. We will be able to have financial freedom. We won't have to deal with all the stuff. We're just dealing with a fight that then they fight you phase for a few more years, and then we'll be in the clear. And I'm not like, everyone has predictions. I don't know if I 100% subscribe to those timelines. The optimist in me does, but the realist in me maybe says longer. But for me personally, that's what I'm thinking of, is we have some stuff to get through. And after we're through all this, I think that we get to say relax is the right word. But after, I think that the mission that we've been building on for all these years is going to succeed, and we're just going to have to like make it through a few hard years.
I wonder what the form is of that. I think when you say hard years, I think that's right. But I think it's right for a certain segment. So we're definitely, you know, in the privacy world, we're at the fight you face. And in some ways, we've kind of been at that in different jurisdictions over some period of time. And in some places, I feel like we've made headway and we have good advocacy, for example, with certain politicians in Washington, D.C. And things like that, where we didn't have that kind of visibility before. Mm-hmm. What I've also seen is propensity or a lot of capitulation in order to get like other things that they want. And so even the softening of language, even though they're ideologically aligned. So there might be a lot of energy and support and things for, you know, TradFi crypto. Mm-hmm. And we may have some really hard seasons for the thing that we really want to build. And I'm wondering about whether that, you know, the part of what's important is not that, like, Zcash, I don't see as only the ever tool, right? There would be multiple chains and multiple uses for different things, but it's an option for everybody, that it's an option for everybody to use. Mm-hmm. Extremely important. That fight, I think, will be hard. And I wonder if some of this comes about like what Balaji had talked about in the network state, where you have very kind of strong communities of ideology that are rejecting state-based money and embracing these alternatives in order to create the kind of communities and worlds they want, and that it breaks apart that way, rather than this kind of dichotomy of you know, just, you know, state money or crypto, but that the those things will all continue to exist. But the state power will be undermined by communities that are banding together that have kind of like ideas. And we'll see how that turns out. Those tend to be more anti-fragile, right, than these kind of brittle big government constructs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's no better time to be alive and playing with this stuff. It's the most exciting time of, you know, my entire kind of, I didn't say professional career. I got involved in computers when I was super, super young, but it's hard and it's mind, it's mind blowing the work that's being done and how the world is changing through this work that these communities are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be exciting 2024 and beyond. Great time to be alive. Where can people follow you and your awesome future work on ECC, et cetera?
So Twitter is just at J Swihart, Swihart, J Swihart. And then I'm around on the forum and in some Telegram groups and some things like that. I think I'm at Josh Swihart on Telegram.
All right, fantastic. Well, thanks very much for the chat and hope you have a good one.
You too. Thanks for having me.